This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Scalina. And Adam is not here this week just for the introduction. But lucky for all of us, he was here for our conversation with this week's guest, past guest fan favorite, Dustin Woodhouse. What to say about Dustin by way of introduction? I would say he's been on the program at least 8, 9, 10 times. He's kind of comes on once every 6 months, I think we were thinking. And it's always one of my favorite conversations. And there's a few reasons why. I mean, he's so smart and has so many insights and unique insights on Canada's lending environment and the real estate market. And he packages things in such an interesting way. And this conversation is a real treat because he was, as many of you will know, the president of Mortgage Architects up until very recently. And over the last couple of months, Dustin's taken a hiatus. You know, he's up in Squamish, mountain biking, dirt biking, skiing up until recently. But he's spending a lot of time in the woods thinking about the Canadian lending environment and where we've went wrong, where we've went right, and why it's so challenging for people to enter into the residential real estate market right now. And it doesn't have to do with just interest rates. That's the interesting part. He really unpacks our regulatory framework and the changes that have been made over the last 15 years to make real estate more challenging for people in Canada's middle class. So stay tuned for that. It's a great conversation with Dustin. But a few housekeeping items before we get to our talk with Dustin. First of all, of course, this podcast is sponsored by the MLA Newswire Weekly, a pre-sale update brought to you by the MLA Canada Advisory Team. The headline from MLA this week, quite fitting based on this conversation, interest rate cuts just not cutting it. So despite the Bank of Canada's effort to ease borrowing costs with 3 rate cuts so far this year, housing affordability remains a major hurdle for buyers. So as we've talked about on the show, home sales in August fell by 17.1% compared to last year, so August 2023, and are 26% below the 10-year seasonal average. While the recent cuts offer some relief for those with variable rate mortgages, a noticeable shift in sales may not happen right away until borrowing costs come down even further. So as we move into the fall, the pre-sale market is expected to see cautious activity with slower sales momentum and longer marketing periods. But a gradual market recovery is expected as cautious buyers slowly re-enter the market and while resale listings are absorbed. So as that inventory is cleared, the market could experience a steady uptick in activity. But the increase, and this is really interesting because we've seen so many demand shocks over the last 10, 15 years in Vancouver. The increase in sales is likely to be gradual rather than immediate. So just as it took several months for rate cuts to ripple through the economy and impact the housing market on the way up, we can expect a similar timeline for the effects of rate cuts to be fully felt on the way down. If you liked what you heard today, subscribe to the MLA Newswire, a daily email roundup of the latest real estate news and market insights. Visit mlacanada.com to subscribe now. We are also sponsored by our real estate team here in Vancouver, Scalina Real Estate. And I did want to highlight a new listing we have coming Monday that you can find over at vancouverrealestatepodcast.com, where we feature all of our listings. This one is a fantastic new listing in the heart of Cambie Village at the Olive Building, Cressy built 2004 at 16th and Cambie. Location wise, it's center ice, right? You have Cambie Village, the Canada Line, steps to the seawall, steps to Home Depot, London Drugs, all the cafes and shops, and a straight shot to either the airport or downtown. It doesn't get much better than 16th and Cambie. The home, unit 320 at 3228 Tupper Street, is 1,062 square feet, two bed, two bath, two solarium in the Olive Building, 2004, Cressy built, fantastic building featuring the Cressy kitchen. Their kitchens are so nice, they trademarked the Cressy kitchen. This kitchen is open concept with stainless steel appliances, granite countertops, gas cooktop, built-in oven. You have to see it to believe it. The unit 320 at 3228 Tupper Street can be found at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And while you're there, if don't only check out that listing and our other featured listings, click sell with us and you can download our most downloaded PDF of all time, the Sold Plan. Of course, this is an acronym that stands for Start On Launch Date. It's basically a simple guide to reverse engineer your home or property for sale to get it sold for top dollar in the shortest amount of time. That's all over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. And maybe we'll cut to our talk with the famous Dustin Woodhouse. It was so great having him back on the show, and this one is fantastic. Enjoy.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that's been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it also is making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects. Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Como Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular with 80% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior one-bedroom all the way to three-bedroom homes remaining. Check out marcon.ca/elmwood for more.
And Matt, we are also excited about Soane House, Marcon's newest community in West Coquitlam, with 165 homes ranging from junior one beds to three beds. Soane House offers the perfect West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Register today at marcon.ca/soanehouse. That's S-O-E-N-H-A-U-S. Or you can learn more at marcon.ca or follow them at Instagram at Marcon Homes.
Marcon, building for life.
Okay, so we're here with Dustin Woodhouse. He is a mortgage expert, author of Be the Better Broker series, very popular speaker who you're going kind of national now. And then, of course, I mentioned this in the intro, but avid extreme sports guy too.
Yeah, I've been able to pursue the sports thing a little bit more this summer because yes, I did change my role within the mortgage industry a little bit to, well, I guess you could arguably call me unemployed.
that wasn't the first thing I was thinking.
Yeah,
seems like you're everywhere.
Everyone kept saying to me, "What are you going to do? What are you going to do?" And I said, "I'm going to try and do nothing all summer long. I'm going to listen to the pitches if they come my way, and a few pitches have come my way, but I'm not going to commit to anything. And frankly, I haven't committed to anything official or organized other than, I've been lucky enough to get invited to a few different events. I was in Edmonton last weekend. I'll be in Toronto next week to jump on a stage and rev up a bunch of mortgage brokers. And actually, in our hometown, October 1st, 2nd, the PAC West Conference, which is probably going to be 90% realtors and 5% mortgage brokers. I've been invited to get up on a stage and rev up a bunch of realtors. So I'm looking forward to that too. So I'll just say it's interesting to me how mortgage brokers and realtors, right? Like we work with the same clients at the same time and we both want the same outcome. We want a happy client in their home who had such a great experience, they're going to refer us both. And yet, brokers and realtors do not ever conference together. We don't go to events together. We don't really know what each other's exact challenges are, the nuances. And lots of times we sort of like lock horns in the middle of a transaction because one of us doesn't understand what's a big deal. You know, there's a listing right now. Three unit strata, no strata council, no strata fees. Fantastic in the MLS notes. This is not fantastic. This is a real problem for financing because when it needs a new roof, what are we doing? There's no capital replacement fund. Like, that's a real problem. There's a number of lenders who won't touch that. But yeah, not much of a summer off. I tried. Hey, you know what? I'll share quickly with you because I didn't know this. How have I lived in Vancouver for more or less my whole life, the better part of 52 years, and been unaware that Mount Hood in Oregon is open for skiing until August 18th?
Wow. Right? Wait a second. And then what is it? Shut down for a couple of weeks?
Like they shut down for a few months. They open traditionally, you know, the November, December. But yeah, they are open for skiing. So I discovered this like August 12th or something. And I have a pretty loose-ish schedule this summer. I've done a good job of that. So I threw the skis and the dirt bike in the van and shot down to Oregon on a Friday.
You know what? I think I saw that on social media. I think you posted about it, right?
Were the conditions a little slushy?
It was a touch slushy. Yeah. it was like 27 Celsius on the mountain.
Wow. Oh my God. Well, Dustin, that's amazing. I'm just thinking for most of our listeners will probably have heard you on the show before because I think you've probably made more appearances than almost anyone in the past 8 or 9 years and definitely a past guest fan favorite. Can you talk a little bit more about your path to unemployment?
Well, look, after, you know, specifically brokering, you know, being like face to face with residential clients from 2008 into 2018, during that sort of 10 plus year run, Angela, my amazing underwriter, and myself, we funded 1,695 mortgages. So it was a phenomenal experience. And through that, I kept getting asked by brokers, hey, can you have a coffee and tell me, you know, how you found success in this space? And I thought, you know what? It'd be easier to just write a book rather than have the same conversation over and over on a weekly basis. I don't know if I was right about that. The book turned into 4 books. But once the books went out there, which really it was just about like, hey, you know what? I actually don't have time for the coffee, but like, here's a copy of the book. I was just going to give them away. Like, here's a copy of the book. Unexpectedly, what happened is almost within 30 days of the first book coming out, I got a call from a RE/MAX office, a wonderful, wonderful man named Pierre in Ottawa. He called me and said, hey, would you come speak at our opening kickoff? And I was like, sure, I guess. Never really done any public speaking per se, but he offered to fly me out there and put me up in the Fairmont and actually pay me money. And I was like, holy cow, like, I had no idea. It wasn't by design. And then as it turned out, I never met a microphone I didn't like. So I started doing a lot of speaking back and forth across the country, got to know brokers and all kinds of different executives within the industry. And ultimately in 2018, that resulted in conversation with a well-known gentleman in our industry who said, hey, I'm thinking about putting a new president in place for Mortgage Architects. What do you think of these names? And I said, well, they're all great people, but I think you should put me in there. He kind of looked at me like, really? Yeah. And it was just the right timing. And so, you know, we wound up, it all got contracted out, but we did the obligatory look each other in the eye and shake hands. And I committed to 5 years. And 5.5 years later, I said, you know what? It's been awesome, but I got to go be me. I don't know exactly what that means. I'm not sure I still do. So in December of last year, I gave my 6 months notice. And by June 15th of this year, out of that role, and literally just like exhaled for about 2 weeks, just like, whoo. I didn't know what to do without 100 emails in my inbox every morning and the phone blowing up. It was a really weird feeling to not be needed.
Was that the most challenging role you found yourself in?
I have never made so many decisions per day for so many days in a row in my life. I don't think I took 2 days in a row off in the 5 years plus that I was in that role, because I didn't feel like I could step away from it. And it was also a little addictive, because you're constantly being asked to make decisions. And some of them are pretty big decisions. You know, they're $50,000, $100,000, one way or the other decisions. And it's, and obviously it feels amazing to be in such a special role within the industry, and only a fool would walk away from that. That thought's gone through my mind a few times. Like, that was kind of the top-ish job in the industry. Like, it was certainly one of the top 20 roles, let's say, in the industry. But yeah, the intensity of it, as addictive as it was, that's, I think, my biggest challenge is just, like, I slip right into 70, 80-hour work weeks. I'll work 6-7 days a week. You know, we touched on the skiing thing. So yeah, I'd have a 50-day ski season. But what people didn't realize is I would work from 6 in the morning till noon. Noon, I would, that was like my cutoff. Like, okay, bolt out to the truck, drive up to Whistler for 1 o'clock, ski for 2 to 3 hours until the lifts close, get back home by 5:30, sit down for another couple hours at the computer. Like, that was a Saturday, that was a Sunday. So, oh, did you ski to both days of the weekend? Sure. Also worked about 20 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. You know?
And as I say, without getting too deep into it, I will just say that I had a close friend of mine that had a pretty life-changing experience. I refer to him as Mr. Perspective. And Mr. Perspective gave me a lot of perspective over the last 12 months. And I just thought, yeah, like, turning 53 this year, the clock is ticking. I'd like to have a 100-day ski season. There's some other things I'd like to do, and I'm not going to do them if I'm putting 70, 80, 90 hours a week in for the man, right? So we'll see. I'll probably still wind up working 70, 80 hours a week, but now it'll be for my own stuff.
Right. Right. You know, as a total aside, just thinking about those big decisions, you know, like, you're as a mortgage broker or as a realtor, it seems to me like we're, you know, guiding and, you know, contextualizing, but ultimately helping people through situations where they're making decisions. Did you find it hard to go into a role where you were making big decisions all the time, or did you have strategies, or do you miss it? Like, because it makes me think of Obama's book almost, where he talks, I think it was in his book, about, you know, he wanted somebody else to pick out his shirt in the morning because he didn't want to waste the energy on, you know, what he was going to eat or what he was going to wear. Like, there was a whole kind of philosophy to being in a role like that.
Yeah, you definitely streamline a lot of things in your life, and you pay a little extra in various areas of your life where a lot of other people would look at you kind of sideways, like really? Like something as simple as valet parking. Anytime valet parking was available, I would valet park, because it was just one less thing to worry about, think about, figure out, get frustrated over, spend time on. Like, if I could shave 10 minutes back out for me for $20, it was worth it. And there's like a lot of things like that. But yeah, I think as a realtor or a broker, you know, you feel a little bit of the weight of the world with each client that you're dealing with, and you're helping them through what is typically the largest purchase they're ever going to have in their life, the largest dollar value transaction. Certainly in the Vancouver market, it's probably going to be the largest transaction of their lives. And it's unbelievably important, you know, that they land in the right neighborhood and the right home and the right financing, like that it's all going to work for them long term. So there's a lot of pressure there. And then when you're basically at the top of a pile of 2,000 mortgage brokers and 24 staff, you know, all those little challenges, well, I shouldn't say little, the big challenges that an individual broker has that blows up, those float up the top to you. So basically every single day, I had that once in a career, once every 10 years, once every 5 years situation to deal with, because I've got 2,000 brokers. So it was, as I say, it was a little addictive. It was super interesting. And I took the responsibility really seriously. But yeah, there were a number of times that these situations would land on my desk. And you know, you have to very quickly figure out the path forward. Okay, who zigged when they should have zagged? Was this the broker? Was this the client? Are we going to lawyer up? Or are we not going to lawyer up? And of course, the best solution is always, guys, try and talk it through.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right? Like, work it through. Don't cling to your, you know, $1,000, $2,000, $5,000. Don't cling to a little bit of money that could solve a really big problem. You know, like most, I would say one of the most common things I would say, nearly every problem in the real estate industry can be solved with a check. It's just how big is that check and who's writing that check. And one word that the professionals would do well to eliminate from the vocabulary would be principal. Don't get hung up on it's the principle of the matter. Don't get hung up on who should have known what, when, how, who should have understood what. Like, no. What does it take to make the other side happy? How fast can I make them happy? And, you know, if you can write a check for $3,000 right now that you shouldn't have to write, you shouldn't have to write that check. It's not your fault. You're not in the wrong. But if you can write that check and make this situation go away right away and have at least a happy-ish client versus digging your heels in, lawyering up, and going through a 2-year process where, guess what? Your insurance company is going to want to settle. Like, your insurance company is not interested in the principle of the thing.
Yeah.
So it's going to settle out. Why not settle it out this week without newspapers, without regulators, without media, without social media blasts? Like, make it go away fast. Fix the problem and just own it.
That's funny. That reminds me of actually transactions. A good friend of mine always says there's, you know, so many deals, great deals out there that pride has gotten in the way of, right? Which when you think about it, like both on the buy and sell side, people that get hung up on, well, it's the principle of it. It's like, no, that's a pretty good offer, you know, that's a pretty good deal.
It cuts both ways, right? I mean, for the client, hey, because obviously this podcast is more client facing than, you know, mortgage broker, realtor facing. Let's take the client's position. Even, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Client, when you're right and that other person's wrong and you feel that the offer is just not good enough, having been a client on the wrong end of a situation, long story short, it was a $20,000 deposit. Our lawyer advised us as the buyers not to complete. Then everybody sued everybody. And we were told we were in the right, 100% in the right. Well, okay, 2.5 years later, $25,000 in total legal fees later, we were awarded our $20,000 deposit back and $3,000 of allowable costs. So we didn't get our 25 grand in legal fees back. We got 3 grand back plus our original 20. So we spent 22 to get our 20 back. So you can do the math on that, and then add in the 2.5 years or so of stress and strain, and like, what's this going to be like, and the emotional roller coaster, and the anxiety, and then you run into that realtor or whoever, the seller, you run into them at the grocery store because you live in the same neighborhood. You know, in hindsight, if we could have agreed to split the deposit and taken a $10,000 loss and just walked away on day one, I'm certain that my wife at the time and I wouldn't have done that because it was the principle. But in hindsight, you know, we should have, because I don't think enough people factor in the emotional tolls that those conflicts take. But,
right. Yeah. Hey, some sage advice to kick off the podcast here, Dustin. Well, you know what I'm kind of interested in is, you know, you've been in the industry and, you know, 70, 80 hour weeks for
16 years.
Yes, 16 years. So you've had a couple months here to go off into the mountains and kind of think deeply about things.
what's going on in the market right now from your new vantage point?
Well, I mean, I don't know. What can I say that will be new? I mean, you guys have a lot of great guests that cover a lot of topics. I mean, hey, I can keep it light and we can talk about Russia.
Yeah.
No, you know, they were just in the news because their central bankers were contemplating increasing interest rates from 18% to 20%. So, you know, just one more thing that, points to Canada being not such a bad spot to be in the world. 18% interest rates in Russia, looking to go towards 20% because of unchecked inflation. So, yeah, there's a lot of countries out there that are still battling with severe inflation and you know, unbelievable interest rates. But look, I think, you know, more realistically, closer to home, one of the things that I just picked up at a recent presentation listening to an economist, he didn't say it in so many words, but I was thinking to myself, what this means to me, and I'll share with you the details, but the takeaway for me was rents. I mean, I never thought they were ever going to go down, but not only are rents going to continue to rise in the provinces where they're capped, they're going to rise by that maximum capped amount. Provinces where they're unchecked, where there are no rent controls, you're going to keep seeing, you know, 10%, 15% annual rent increases. That's not going to change. But in the ones where there are those government controls, I think you're going to see more and more like landlord associations grouping together, lobbying for special exceptions. And I'll tell you what I think a special exception might look like. And it would be around home insurance and strata insurance, because here's a couple stats that kind of blew my mind. I wrote them down and I double checked my notes and I had it in my memory correctly because they stick. 2008 in Canada, $40 million in total sort of disaster claims. So weather related events. So it doesn't matter how you feel about climate change. We're just going to talk about insurance claim change, which leads to insurance rate change. 2008, $40 million in total weather-related disaster claims. 2023, 15 years later, it jumps from $40 million to $3.1 billion in 2023 total payouts. And just this August, August 6th, actually, Calgary suffered an unbelievable Easter came early, right? It was a hailstorm of eggs. Like egg-sized hail falling from the sky, not the kind of Easter eggs people were hoping for. And $2.8 billion is the estimated damage of that one hailstorm, basically ensuring that 2024 will outpace, you know, combine that with the Jasper wildfires, which I think that they're pegging that around 800 million. So we're easily going to be over 4 billion in claims in 2024. And of course, this individual event that happens in this one city in Canada, well, the insurers are national and they spread the risk and they spread the pain across the nation. So whether you're in Halifax, Moncton, or Victoria, you know, whatever's happening in Calgary, it's impacting you. And so as I say, one thing is certain, and that is that the cost of insurance is going to increase significantly. And that's not looking like it's going to change anytime soon. So what's that going to do to rents?
That's an interesting thing just thinking out loud here, because yeah, it's always pegged to, or at least historically in BC, rent increases were pegged to inflation. But one of the key kind of components of the costs for landlords is not going to rise with inflation. It's going to rise dramatically quicker, which is that insurance, right? Is basically what you're saying. So it's not like, oh, you know, inflation's at 2 or 3%, but if insurance costs are going through the roof, that's a real challenge.
Yeah. I mean, to have your insurance.
And a risk, I guess, a real risk that a lot of landlords potentially haven't thought about.
And in a 3-year period, your insurance could go from $1,200 to $2,400. Well, there's another $100 a month. Where's that coming from? And then on top of inflation, interest rates, you know, everything else. And you know, that would lead me to another observation that I would say I've made from my home in the mountains. I'm fortunate enough to live in Squamish, BC, the adventure capital of the world. It's an amazing spot. Lots of people want to come here. They've stripped away lots of Airbnb rules or doing everything they can to try and create more long-term housing. But there's a Facebook page, Squamish Housing. As a landlord, and I certainly had a great number of clients of mine who bought a second property. And you go back to 2010 and you walk into, you know, a house party, a family event on a long weekend, whatever it is, and you say, hey, we bought an investment condo. People go, wow, good for you. And it was a good thing. Like, good for you. And you know, it was a good thing. You're creating housing. Like, this is not a bad thing. These days, nobody talks about buying an investment property. If they've bought one, they don't tell anyone. Because if you look at the comments section in these Facebook groups where someone posts an ad for their house for rent, their condo for rent, their townhouse, their basement suite, they get ripped in the comments section for being like greedy, you know, billionaire pig. Like, it's just, it's unbelievable the abuse that there is there. I think it's really unfortunate. I mean, I understand where that energy is coming from, but it's so being directed in the wrong direction. Like, you know, these folks bought a house in my neighborhood and then their life had some changes that you would be like, whoa, wow, that's too bad. Like, you're not going to be able to move here. And oh, you still closed on the property because you didn't really have a choice there. And you haven't been able to sell the property. So you want to rent the property because, of course, you can't leave your home vacant in this province without incurring a whole bunch of additional taxes. So you're sort of between this rock and hard place. It's not selling. You don't want to pay a vacant home tax. So we better rent it. And then just getting thrashed for asking for market rent, like not asking any more than people are paying around the neighborhood. But market rents are high. They are. There's no two ways about it. And yeah, as I say, I think that's one of the fundamental shifts I've seen. It's very difficult to qualify to buy an investment property. So virtually nobody is. The mom and pop landlords are becoming a thing of the past. And it's very difficult to actually be a landlord because of the abuse that you take. And it really only takes, at this point, one bad tenant experience and there's a for sale sign out front. And that's not good for BC because we have had virtually zero investment for decades when it comes to purpose-built rental housing. There's a little bit more happening right now, but I don't know. There's a bigger observation for you.
That actually, and I don't know, Adam, if you have thoughts on this, I'm sure you do, but you know, I'm just thinking as you were speaking, there seems to be a move right now with the change to the tenancy rules too, where there's like social media posts about how to exploit the rules or potentially profit from the rules if your landlord is selling the property or whatever, right? To challenge the notice or whatever. And when I've looked at those posts, the tone is so, you know, if you can afford to be a landlord, you either deserve it or you can afford to pay out whatever the extortionate amount of money is. But actually, it just makes me think the discourse, how it's changed in the last 10, 15 years is actually so detrimental to building more housing, right? Like it's actually because it's a scary time to be a landlord for a number of reasons. But one is because there seems to be a growing sentiment that, you know, you deserve whatever you get. And
you're an evil capitalist.
Yeah. But it just leads to like, why on earth would you want to be involved?
Yeah. Well, and then you look at the commercial side. Right? Like, you don't pay your rent on a commercial property on the first of the month. Okay. You have 10 days. On the 10th day, the locks change and anything inside that property can be sold to pay the balance of the rent owing. Like, it's just hardcore, hasn't changed in 50 years, and there's no change coming because that's business. But on the residential side, I mean, I know a young woman who had a rental property, and it was a lucky situation that she found herself in, and she was able to hang on to this second property. It was her first home. And she was able to hang on to it and was keeping it as maybe a fallback position, but put tenants in there. And after 4 months of the tenant not paying rent, they got a lawyer. It's like, for what? Like, what are they getting a lawyer for? Like, they haven't paid rent for 4 months. And stretched it out to 6 months and then negotiated like this $500 a month premium on the original rent number to pay the now, like, what was it, about $15,000 back rent that they owed. And of course, you know how that story ends. You know, 4 months later, they couldn't pay the $2,500, paying $3,000. That's not easier. So they made it 3 or 4 months and then they stopped paying again. And, you know, ultimately that homeowner went to the property to clean it up because it was left in a bit of a state. And, you know, they're cleaning up kids' toys out of the basement. Like, it was like the midnight move had happened. And so, like, they felt genuinely bad for this person who owed them like $18,000 in back rent at this point. But they still, like, they genuinely felt bad. And it was unfortunate that the whole thing had played out. But you've got this unhappy tenant that who knows where they've gone on to, this unhappy landlord. And what do you think that homeowner did? They put a for sale sign out front. They were like, I can't go through this again. This has been brutal. Like, they're not independently wealthy. They're not a multimillionaire. They're not super liquid. Like, not having that $2,500 a month worth of rent coming in, having to pay that on top of their own mortgage payment, stretched them. Like, there was no, their vacation was canceled. Like, they did not go anywhere for the summer because they were spending $18,000 keeping a second home that they had no access to. And so it's like a ripple effect. And then that story, of course, well, now I'm sharing it on a podcast, but that story ripples through a bunch of other homeowners. And, oh, maybe we should just put our property on the market. And the other thing is, you know, you really haven't had, as I mentioned earlier, people able to qualify to buy that second or third or certainly that fourth door or beyond for a number of years. So a lot of your landlords that own 2, 3, 4, 5 properties, they're in their late 50s, 60s, 70s, and they're getting to a point where, well, you know what? Maybe we should just cash out. You know, we bought these places decades ago. We've got lots of equity there. Do we really need the headaches and, or the potential headaches? And so I've talked with brokers who are saying, yeah, no, we are seeing some of our clients, and you guys may see that as well, where they're starting to liquidate some of that portfolio. Rental stock, bottom line, is shrinking, not increasing, from what I can see anecdotally.
Yeah, we're seeing the same thing. I used to hear, you know, a couple times a year horror stories about, you know, from landlords. Now it's almost weekly, I feel like I hear one of those stories. And I think you're right. And I also think that I think it is having the ripple effect is in place, but I really do think that a lot of people just don't really understand the magnitude of, I think, what's coming and what's going to be changing now. And I think we're starting to see a lot of complicated real estate deals where vacant possession is becoming a real challenge. And that is, again, having huge consequences for completions and buyouts. And it reminds me much more of, we've talked about it on the show, but kind of how commercial leasing works when somebody goes to sell a commercial property and has a, you know, maybe a legacy rent or something in place. And there's a negotiation that can often be tens of thousands of dollars, right? Now we're starting to see that's becoming common. It's terrifying for people that own revenue properties.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and but I'm just thinking about this impact of social media, right? Because I was in a situation where somebody who was buying their first home was told they get vacant possession, and it was challenging to get vacant possession. Let's put it that way. And they went on Reddit threads. This is how I kind of stumbled upon these Reddit threads. And there's like basically how-to guides for people that are getting notice that they are, you know, that somebody's bought their home and that they need to move. It's like, here's what you need. Here's how much money you can ask for. Here's how to do it. It's interesting just how the the narratives have changed and how social media, because I always think we always talk about the residential tenancy, you know, rules and how that impacts everything. But I haven't thought as much about just general discourse on the internet and how that impacts things.
And here's the thing about that is that on the lending side, the lenders are aware that a tenant may not go gracefully. And when it's an owner-occupied purchase and that financing is based on the property being owner-occupied, which may relate to the size of down payment required, the interest rate, the amortization, there's a number of variables that the buyer is trying to achieve to qualify for that financing and make it work, they may not be able to get the financing without a guaranteed vacant possession. So now the seller can't get the buyer in without that. So it's challenging.
You know, Dustin, we've been asking people on the show, I think probably since interest rates started rising, and it was mainly an interest rate related question. And the question was, does investing in Vancouver real estate still make sense? Maybe in the context of this conversation so far, I'll put the same question to you. You know, and thinking like what has to, if it doesn't, what has to change in order to make it make sense? Because we need people to be putting money into the housing market.
You know, honestly, I purchased my first investment property. I believe I would have been 22 years old. I was 22 years old. I needed a whopping $7,000 down payment, which at 22, even 30 years ago, $7,000 actually wasn't that difficult to pull together. It really wasn't. And for years, for the better part of the last 30 years, I have always, always advocated for ownership of residential real estate. Like, set a goal of 5 doors, 10 doors. Boy, if you can own 10 doors, you know, get relatively deep into paying those properties off, hold them for 10 years, 15 years by then, your cost to carry, the rents have gone up. There's a margin there. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Urch, you know, needle scratch on the record, right? Like, wait a minute. Is it still? And I don't sing that same tune anymore. I'd no longer say to people, oh yeah, if you can buy 5 to 10 residential properties, 5 to 10 condos downtown. No. I do still believe that owner-occupied, absolutely. You should own an owner-occupied property if you can. Makes a ton of sense. I used to make the argument about, well, look, if you can't afford to buy close to work and you want to live close to work, say downtown Vancouver, for instance, buy something in the valley, rent that out, and then use that rent to pay rent downtown. Because you've always been able to rent pretty high dollar properties for pretty reasonable amounts, actually, downtown. The rents have never really made a lot of sense, especially as you go higher up the ladder. It really gets disconnected and makes no sense. And it still to this day is that way. But yeah, like being a landlord, I am no longer encouraging that. Being a homeowner, absolutely. And you know, another, as I say, piece of my message was always buy as far west as you possibly can and buy as close to a detached home with a basement suite as you possibly can. Because a detached home with a basement suite as far west in the greater Vancouver area, it will drop the least when the market drops. It will move up the most when the market rises. And it will always have tenants. It will always be in demand. And I have a few clients to this day who did take that advice back in 2010. And they are in phenomenal positions. You know, I wish I'd taken my own advice to a greater extent. But I don't feel that way at all anymore about residential real estate. It's a challenging environment in a lot of ways.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
This podcast is sponsored by Common Ground Consulting. Are you developing in the Lower Mainland?
Common Ground Consulting is a development management and consulting company with experience in single family, townhouses, multifamily, and commercial developments.
What I love about Common Ground, Adam, is they manage the whole development process, from due diligence and feasibility reports for initial purchase of land to completing rezoning, development permits, and building permits.
They streamline the whole process with strong relationships with sub-consultants and municipalities and a deep understanding of all city requirements.
Common Ground Consulting. Feasibility and efficiency prioritized every step of the way.
Learn more at commonground-consulting.com or 604-807-6419.
We are also sponsored by Oakwin Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakwin.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakwin, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakwin.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
Thinking about where your money would be going then, or where you would be advising people, are you now looking at commercial real estate exclusively, or have you expanded your portfolio in the stock market, or are you looking at Alberta or north or maybe south of the
border?
We're
going to start a new podcast.
I mean, I've always said I'm the guy you come to get the money. I'm not the guy that's going to tell you what to do with your money. I'll give you a little bit of a general sense of what I'm doing and why. And like I say, for a long time, I was buying residential rentals, and here was why. But I've owned commercial, like tilt-up strata units over the years, on and off, and those have always been great. And at this point, I am out of residential. I own some tilt-up commercial, industrial, and I feel pretty comfortable in that spot. And on the residential side, maybe I'll go be a tenant for a while. You know, I mean, as I mentioned, you start looking in, say, downtown Vancouver, for instance, which is where I've been looking. And I mean, you can rent $3 million apartments for $5,500 a month. I mean, I'm fudging the numbers a little bit there, but I'm not far off of that. And $5,500 a month is a crazy rent number. But I'm juxtaposing that against a $2.5, $3 million apartment, which to purchase that, you're putting $1 million down. You're paying a $12,000 a month mortgage payment, plus $2,000 in strata, plus $1,000 in insurance. Like, it's so ludicrous, the difference between owning those halo properties and renting them, that it just doesn't even make sense to look at buying those, in my opinion, right now. But again, I mean, I could be completely wrong. That $3 million apartment 4 years from now could be $5 million. Mm-hmm. So there's also that aspect to it. But on a cash flow month-to-month basis, it's an interesting time to consider on the residential side, yeah, maybe being a tenant isn't the worst move. But again, ultimately, people want that stability, right, of home ownership. And so I would never shy away from owning my own personal domain residentially. Although, again, your options, decide you want to go on a one-year cruise around the world and you've got, you know, unique belongings, you've got personal stuff that you don't feel like packing up and putting in storage, well, you got to figure it out, because you're going to pay a vacant home tax if you leave your home unoccupied for more than 180 days, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of crazy. Like, you don't quite have the say in the use of your own property that you used to have. So it's an interesting time in that regard. And you know, that plays into one other thing that I can talk about, which is where a lot of this change is coming from. And it is regulatory. Like, we're in a very heavy regulatory regime change environment. Realtors are being regulated more than ever. Mortgage brokers are being regulated more than ever. The banks are under increased scrutiny. And so it isn't just landlords and tenants that are having struggles. It's everyone in anything to do with real estate is under this unbelievable continuing sort of evolution of change. And there's a new one rolling down the pike at us on the financing side called loan to income. And they were originally going to implement this in October. They've kicked that can into Q1 of 2025. But the Office of the Superintendent of Financial Institutions, the division of the government that overlooks the bank, they're rolling out this thing called an LTI, a loan to income limit. And they're basically going to say, if, for instance, if you make $100,000 a year, your mortgage shall not exceed $450,000. And there's a lot of questions around how that is exactly going to be implemented. It's only going to be implemented on borrowers who are putting 20% or more down. So it's not going to affect insured mortgages. The buyer's putting less than 20% down. It's not going to affect renewals. Nobody's coming to tinker with renewals. Renewals, for the most part, just continue renewing. But it is going to affect the buyer with 20% down who is perhaps self-employed, who is perhaps incorporated, who is perhaps leaving some of their income inside that corporation or income splitting, or for whatever reason, not pulling all of their income out of the corp. They're still paying tax on that income inside the corporation. And one day when they pull those retained earnings out, they'll pay personal tax on it as well. So there's nothing dodgy going on. But there are a number of people who own businesses who don't draw huge paychecks, right? They're trying to increase the value of the business. They're pulling the bare minimum out to live on. You know, you hear about the founder eating the ramen noodles, sleeping on the cot in the corner, pulling virtually nothing out personally because they're leaving all the money in the corporation to try and grow the business. They want to hire new staff, buy new equipment, whatever that might be. And a lot of those clients, they might have a private banking relationship, a business banking relationship, and the bank is being told, not individually are we going to measure this, but we're going to measure your total bucket of mortgages that you've put out, and your total bucket can't exceed this 4.5-to-1 ratio. So any buyer, as I say, who comes through the door with $100,000 personal income looking for a $500,000 mortgage or bigger, and justifying it by saying, well, look, I've got this corporation. I could have pulled $200,000 out, but I didn't. The money's right here in the corporation, but we're growing the business. Normally would qualify for that extra amount. But now the lender's going to have to cherry pick who they're going to give that exception, that approval to, because they're only going to be able to give so many of those exceptions out. Right? So they're going to have to balance their books. So as people come in putting 30, 40, 50% down, as people come in with huge incomes borrowing small amounts, it tilts their book in the right direction where they have room to make some of these exceptions. But then if they have a run of people coming in with a lower income looking for the higher mortgage amount, they're going to have to make decisions. They're going to have to start to look at that group of applicants and say, well, only you are going to get that exception. You do not get that exception. And really what I'm talking about there is a theme that has been adopted in this country effectively, one could argue, in 2017 when the stress test came into play. And it's about demand-side economics. It's about reducing demand. I mean, it should never be misunderstood what OSFI, the Office of the Superintendent of Financial Institutions, mandate is. It is not to put Canadians in homes. It is not to look out for you and your family. It is to protect the stability of the Canadian banking system. That's it. To protect the, that's OSFI's mandate, protect the banks. Well, what better way to protect the banks than only allow the banks to lend money to people who don't really need the money, right? To only lend money to the most well-heeled, well-capitalized individuals. And so what am I really saying there? I mean, I'm not getting up on a soapbox, but maybe I am a little bit. The government regulations that have been coming into play since 2016 onward, they are skewed towards pushing the bottom middle class, the middle of the middle class, and now the upper side of the middle class out of real estate ownership. And increasingly, I'm sure you guys have seen the change in the demographic in your careers. You think about who you worked with when you first started as realtors, what those people did for a living, and who you work with today. They're not the same people, right? Like, they can't afford to buy anything today. That single income earner earning $100,000 a year with $30,000 or $40,000 saved up. Yeah, sorry. Maybe if we go 50 kilometers east, we might find something for you.
Right.
Maybe.
I'm just trying to think of how this would ever, you know, because I'm thinking of younger millennials and Gen Z or whoever the next group is and how important home ownership is in the psyche of Canadians. And that doesn't seem to be changing. Does this become, I mean, you mentioned OSFI and most people's eyes glaze over just with the acronym, right? Like, does this become a political issue? And does it ever, from a regulatory standpoint, become a political issue where people are saying, why, you know, you're making this too onerous for, you know, regular folks to get into the market? Do you think that changes, or is it just like too complicated and obscure essentially for most people to even to cross their mind?
I think it's too complicated and obscure until it isn't, right? And until suddenly the obscure becomes commonplace, until suddenly nobody you know is qualifying to buy a place,
right?
And you're all of voting age and you're actually thinking of going to vote. And so I think very quickly it could turn, you know, in the industry, we're all kind of like, how has this not been an issue for the last couple of elections? Because we see what's coming. But people aren't feeling that pain. More and more certainly are now. I mean, you look at Japan. Japan has 99-year amortizations. Our own former Bank of Canada governor, Stephen Poloz, in his book, The Coming Age of Uncertainty, he writes and makes the case for a 50-year amortization. I was like, Mr. Poloz, my man. Because I wrote a blog post about a 50-year amortization around the same time. And I was like, wow, this guy is way smarter than me, way more successful, way more prominent. And he's advocating for the same thing. I reached out to him and said, you know, love your book, especially this chapter.
Great speaker as well.
Yeah, that's right. You guys have seen him live in action, right? And that was actually the beginning of that relationship. It was just like, geez, like this guy gets it. Like a 50-year amortization is not a bad thing and does not actually have to be inflationary. You need to get first-time home buyers into the market. I mean, they're the oxygen that keeps the market alive. You can't have a move-up buyer without the first-time buyer buying the thing from the move-up buyer. I mean, someone's got to buy that thing from the move-up buyer for them to move up. And I think it will come to a head, certainly if not in time for the next election cycle, which seems like it could be a lot sooner than anybody thinks.
Right.
All of a sudden here, I certainly believe the election after this, it is just going to be absolutely front and center. We see the term housing crisis ad nauseum now, right? Like it's you're almost desensitized to it,
right?
But what is going to be done to get younger demographic into the market? And got to be around the finance side.
One of the questions I had, and of course I know when you're on, usually it's like we scrap all the questions and just talk, but one of the first questions was, have you been surprised by the weak activity with these three rate cuts? But it strikes me that based on our discussion so far, you're probably not. Like, I guess, do you see, like I was thinking, what does it take to reignite, you know, the market and get sales volumes up to even the 10-year averages at this point?
You know what? I actually can give you some pretty specific numbers. I can give you a pretty specific answer. So if you look at the impact of a quarter point rate cut on the amount of mortgage money somebody qualifies for, it's nil. Like it's a rounding error. It just doesn't matter. Like, oh you have $8,000 more purchasing power, right? Like it's nothing to speak of. you need a good 2% cut. That's when you're going to get back into a zone where, oh, that gives us a little more breathing room. So we have a long ways to go. And if we can get, you know, a solid 2-2.5% below where we were, then your stress test comes down back to an almost normal number, you know, right? Normal comes back down to that 5.25 baseline. And we certainly need to get there to really see life come back. Look, a lot of us, myself included, we were crossing our fingers, which is not a strategy. And we were hoping, which is not a strategy. It might be a tactic. Hope is a tactic, but it's not a strategy. We were crossing our fingers and hoping that that quarter point, half point, 3/4 point reduction we've seen now would psychologically get people back in the game. But it hasn't happened. And a big part of that is because fundamentally, it doesn't get a lot of people back in the game. You know, when you've got stress tests that were reaching 9.7%, like you're qualifying people at 9.7% instead of 5.25, like the amount of mortgage money they qualify for, it's devastated. They don't qualify for anywhere near what they need. And the irony in that is the rent they're paying is often a lot higher than the mortgage payment. And they're like, but why can't I qualify for a mortgage payment equivalent to the rent that I'm paying? Like, well, that's not how it works. Insert painful acronym here. So yeah, we haven't seen the life come back in the market. And no, we're not going to see it. Will another 0.25 get us there? No. Will a 0.5 get us there? No. Will a full point further reduction get us back in a market where something's actually happening? I think we'll be able to feel the pulse at that point. You've had this. The other thing that's happened with that calcification of the market, right? That sort of freezing over, is people start to put their roots in a little bit. Like, you know, but because again, a lot of people have learned that their mortgages may well be portable, but there is a huge asterisk next to the word portable. And your mortgage isn't always portable. You can't always take that mortgage from one property to another. Because, well, first off, you qualified for it at 5.25% stress test. And today you're looking at a 7.7%+ stress test. You may not qualify, you have to re-qualify when you're trying to port your mortgage from one property to another. So even though you want to make a lateral move, you're not buying a more expensive house, you're not looking for more mortgage money, heck, you might even be shrinking the mortgage, $25,000 or something.
Right.
Technically, you don't qualify for that mortgage you have, so you can't move. So we got that problem, right? There's those fundamental ones in the weeds like that.
Yeah, but also I'm just thinking here because I'm just looking at my notes. You know, I think Tiff Macklem was just in England talking about, you know, volatility moving forward in inflation and geopolitical risk, and basically, you know, talking about more volatility in the interest rate environment that we're in. My initial thought, of course, is like, let's drop the stress test. But does that actually make sense in a marketplace with increased volatility?
This is the challenge you have. It's very difficult, especially for any elected official or appointed official, to make an argument in favor of loosening anything ever. And you can go all the way back to 2008 when we had a 40-year amortization, 0% down purchasing. 95% LT loan to value. You could refinance your property up to 95% of the value of the property. We had way looser standards, like unbelievably looser standards. And we went through a massive financial crisis. We didn't come apart at the seams. We bounced back very quickly. So despite these loose lending standards, well, they really weren't that loose, were they? Because we stayed intact. Nonetheless, as soon as those rates started coming down in 2008, and there was that you know, just precipitous drop from 5% to 4.5% to 2.99. I remember when the 2.99 came out in 2009. What you saw was the reduction in the amortization from 40 to 35 to 30 to 25, because every five-year reduction in amortization was the equivalent of a 1% interest rate hike. So as rates came down 3 points, they chopped the amortization by 15 years, which offset the amount of mortgage money you qualified for. Now, this is some really arcane mathematical stuff that, you know, feels like the word arcane. Hard, what does that word get, right? It's awkward stuff, and it's stuff people can't wrap their heads around. But the mathematics, that's what the mathematics are. So when rates come down a point, you reduce the amortization by 5 years, and Joe and Mary Public don't qualify for any more mortgage money because of the low rates. So that's what they did instead of a stress test. They just played with that amortization. But I remember in 2008 saying, who's got their finger over the undo button? When rates go back up to 5%, are we going to get our 40-year amortization back? I bet we don't. I bet we just qualify for less and less and less. And look, it's not a conspiracy. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's just, it's happenstance. It's unintended consequences. But the reality is, what we've created is a situation now where the only people who really qualify for real estate in the major markets are wealthy people. They're well capitalized. They have generational wealth. They have dual six-figure incomes. That's who qualifies because of how restrictive we've made it. And so to your question about, like, isn't the stress test a good idea? I think
I didn't really say that, but
well, sort of.
Yeah. Okay. Implied, I guess. Yeah. Sure. Sorry. Go on.
This is the implied question. Here's the real twist on this. If you stop the average guy in the street and said, hey, were these low rates, like in 2020, for instance, hey, are these low rates allowing Canadians to borrow way more money than they should? Oh, yeah. Should we tighten up lending guidelines? Absolutely. And then that person hangs a right and goes into the bank and says, hey, I need some financing. And the bank says, oh, sorry, you don't qualify. Wait. I didn't mean me. I'm not borrowing more than I can afford. And we weren't. Canadians are inherently conservative. That line of, oh, people are using their home as an ATM. Shut up. Virtually no Canadian is using their home as an ATM. Like, that was from the movie The Big Short, and a great film, wonderful film. The only remotely Canadian thing about the movie The Big Short is Ryan Gosling. That's it. Like, none of the rest of what was happening in that movie is reflective of the way the Canadian mortgage market works. We are Canadian, which is to say we are conservative. The lenders are conservative. The borrowers are conservative. Everyone's conservative. We all are. And so, yeah, unfortunately, we've got this crazy dynamic where the public says, yeah, we should definitely keep people from getting in over their heads. What they're not realizing is they're shooting themselves in the foot. And so this is why our children will live in our basements until we are in the ground. Yeah. Then they can move upstairs.
But they won't be able to move. Oh, God.
It's a very tricky situation, and I've used the term unintended consequences in the past, and one of the previous presidents of CMHC, I felt like it was almost like a personal shot at a blog post I'd written like literally a week earlier, and he came out with a statement, intended consequences. We knew exactly what we were doing. I'm like, man, I was trying to give you a pass, but if you want to own it, you can go ahead and own it. But like, demand side economics hasn't worked ever in history, and it's really not worked in Canadian housing. Demand side economics has been a nightmare, and we've finally woken up to that. But I mean, I've shared a number of times, I can't remember the name of the gentleman that you were interviewing on this podcast, a developer, and it's such a powerful line. And I've shared it many times. I remember this guest you had saying, we are at a stage right now with the cost of materials, the cost of labor, where even if you gave us the land for free, we can't build at a profit. What does that tell you about you? It tells you everything you need to know about the state of housing in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we've got a problem. We've tightened the ability to finance down so tightly. Like, we have reduced the amount of mortgage money that the typical Canadian can borrow by about 60% from 2016 to today. So where someone might have qualified for $1 million mortgage using every little trick in the book, basement suite, rental income, like, you know, child tax credit, like every maneuver you could, they could qualify for as little as $400,000 today. Like, it's crazy, the extreme difference. So we've taken all those buyers out of the market, and yet the prices have not come down because they cannot come down. Because labor costs go up, material costs go up, land cost goes up. So the price of housing will always have to continue to rise. But when you limit everyone's purchasing power so that they can't qualify for the financing, well, you create a housing crisis. So am I making the argument that the federal government is largely responsible for the pickle we're in? They are, from the financing side, their demand side economics, nightmare implementation, and no one is going to have the guts to undo any of that because they're going to get attacked for doing something that's inflationary. It's going to drive housing prices higher. Housing prices have to go higher, or we can't build more housing. You know, and then we can't leave the municipal governments out of the conversation. And I always say, hey, kids, you know why you can't afford a house? You know why nothing new is being built in your community? It's because your parents or grandparents, all the gray hairs and no hairs, like myself, they either went to the municipal meeting and opposed development. They were one of like the seven people that opposed the development and halted the development. Or they were the silent majority that never showed up at any of those meetings and didn't support the development. So in the end, the development didn't happen. And so you've got these crazy bottlenecks at the municipal level. What are we at now? I think in Vancouver, it's 8 years from the time someone signs on the dotted line, we own this land, until a key gets put into the doorknob of a tower.
Yeah.
8 years. At today's interest rates, like the carrying cost on the financing alone, just to hold the land for 8 years while you're waiting and trying to build. Like, yeah. So, you know, between the municipal government throttling developments, the federal government throttling the ability for purchasers to buy. It's kind of a mess right now, isn't it? All right. Have a wonderful day.
Maybe we'll leave it there.
Yeah. And there we are, at time.
Yeah. In all seriousness here, Dustin, maybe we will leave it there, but we do have this segment called The Five Wire. Do you have time to stick around for that?
Yeah, I ran us into overtime. Absolutely. Let's do it.
This podcast is brought to you by Spark, the new development sales and marketing platform.
Adam, the stakes have never been higher for launching a condo project, and today's developers and brokerage teams need to leverage the best tools in order to hit their financing thresholds and to sell out their projects.
Spark is an all-in-one sales and marketing software that includes a comprehensive CRM, inventory management, email marketing, and digital contracts. These tools are custom tailored to the pre-sale process to help you capture leads, increase inventory yield, and transact contracts seamlessly.
And here's the best part, Adam. Spark's team is headquartered right here in Yale Town, and they have over 10 years of experience in helping BC-based developers and brokers bring their projects to market.
So if you're selling a new development, you need to check out Spark at spark.re/VREP. That's spark.re/VREP. And remember, Matt, you can't light the pre-sale world on fire without a spark.
All right. First question for you. One book you've read recently that you would recommend to our audience.
One book that I've read recently. You know what? I'm going to go with, that's too heavy. I'm going to go with a lighter, simpler one. I guess it speaks to my personality a little too much, perhaps. Do Hard Things. Do Hard Things resulted in me buying a 30-pound weight vest and going for a regular hike with this 30-pound weight vest, and it's been good.
Really, eh? Do you find the one thing about, and I haven't read that book, I've heard of that book. Is it one of those books where you're like, all right, you read the title and you're like, okay, I get it. Or is it actually worth going through and reading?
Well, as I say, I never would have, it had good math around the like pounds per inch of pressure in your knee when you run versus walk. And I've never been a runner. Everything ached a little too much when I ran. But as far as getting equivalent cardio, like it unpacked. Yeah. I'm hesitant to use the word because people will not hear it correctly. The word starts with an R. It's rucking. All right. You have a rucksack, a backpack with 30 pounds in it. I'm a fan of rucking. I like to get as much rucking in as I can daily, ideally, right? Yes. So the book, look, it speaks to me because I literally had a slide in one of my very first presentations in 2014 that said, do hard things.
Yeah.
Like it was a 3-word slide. And it's been a mantra of mine, like, whatever is the tougher way to do a thing, yeah, that's probably the way I'm going to do it because it's good training. And then when you have to actually do the thing, maybe it'll be easier. You know, it's one of those things.
Yeah. Fantastic. All right. Two hard things. In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit, and maybe we'll skip rucking, has most improved your life?
a new belief or habit that has affected my life. You know what? I'll speak to something I lost due partly to, 200 days a year of travel, due partly to COVID disrupting things, even when, so now I didn't have to travel, but a bunch of things that I used to go do, I couldn't go do. So if it wasn't travel, then it was COVID, then it was travel again, and my imbalance with work. The value of routine, like the value of actually having good habits where you have that routine, that daily, that weekly, that monthly routine where you're hitting, whatever it might be, the gym X number of days per week at the same time, you're hitting a yoga class or you're going for a hike, or you're catching a sunset, whatever those things are. I really got kind of just rocked completely out of routine over the past 5 years. And it's one of the things that I'm really lasering in on. And I guess the other piece I would put in that, I have an Excel sheet, you can imagine perhaps, that I have as a calendar. And I map out my year in advance. I like to try and keep track of flights and hotels and where I got to be and events, what I got to do. But I have shaded out every Friday. And I am endeavoring to only work 4-day work weeks. And I'll say that's probably a habit that a lot of us could look at adopting. How could I only work a 4-day work week? That would be an interesting one. But the value of routine, once lost to me, I realized, like, I need that.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's super interesting. Huh. Okay. What, a little lighter fare here. I think you mentioned the accountant already. That might've been offline. What have you been binge watching lately or favorite movie?
You know what? I'm a sucker for Guy Ritchie. There was that brief lull in his career there, but, then he had a life change and everything he's made since has been pretty great. I did have occasion, due unfortunately to being laid up for a couple of days, to watch on Netflix, The Gentleman.
Yeah.
I've seen the movie, and now I just watched the series, and I enjoy a good English gangster crime Guy Ritchie.
You know, it's, I don't know if you watched Succession, but the... mm-hmm. The scene that's always, I mean, there's a lot that sticks with me from that show, but the boar on the floor scene, and it just makes me think because in the Gentleman, the be a chicken scene is similar. It's like I wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat from having a dream similar to that or something. I don't know. It's like, it just, so
I'm hoping
powerful.
I haven't made any life choices bad enough to put me in a position that I'm going to have to dance in a chicken suit for somebody.
Yeah, no kidding. Favorite band or music? Or you know, something you've been listening to lately because we've had you on so many times.
Can I take a pass on that question? Because there's another one you've always asked and I have such a good answer for it.
Yeah. Okay. Which I'm trying to think of.
It's your purchase under $1,500.
Oh yeah. Okay.
I forgot to share it last time.
Yeah.
As you know, we were talking at the beginning a little bit about some of the skiing and moto riding and everything else. I bought an Insta360 camera. And for anyone who's into any kind of action sport, or frankly, even if you're just trying to film like kids who are, you know, hard to keep in frame and running around like maniacs, like a kid's birthday party, for instance, this Insta360 is unbelievable. It literally does what it sounds like. It films 360 degrees all at one time. The software eliminates the selfie stick. So I get people all the time saying, did you buy a drone? Because it looks like a drone is following me. And no, it's this Insta360 on a selfie stick that I'll wedge out of my backpack or mount on the handlebars or whatever. And then in editing, you can edit the cut so that you're filming the trail ahead of you and then spin around and you're filming yourself and then look at the sky or look at the ground. And it's amazing. And for parties and events as well. Like, you just walk through with this thing and then in post with your iPhone, you're and it's fun to edit because you're physically dancing around the room, basically spinning your phone around to catch the views. It has been a ton of fun.
Oh, fantastic. All right. Well, hey, that's a good one, man. We should just bring you back for a five wire every couple months. No, great answers. Well, how can now in your new role as I'm not even sure what to call you, but I know you're still very active on social media and you're still out there in multiple conversations that I'm following. So how can people find out more about what you're doing, Dustin?
I do have a weekly blog post mainly aimed at mortgage brokers that goes out from my website, Be the Better Broker, bethebetterbroker.com.ca. I grab it both. I think I got a glitch where you have to type the www in right now to get it to show up live. But yeah, basically if there's an event that I'm speaking at or a conference we're putting together, it's on that website.
Fantastic. Well, we'll have to leave it there and have you back soon, Dustin. I always appreciate your time and insight and wisdom.
Hey, it's always fun to go on a little rant and hopefully my rant works for a few of your listeners.
And just a reminder, if people in Vancouver want to see a talk, where are you going to be at the start of October?
Yeah, October 1st and 2nd at the PAC West Conference, which I imagine will be 95% realtors packed into that event.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but yeah, go for Dustin.
I think it's a great thing. So I've got an hour long segment for rookie realtors. And I'm really looking forward to delivering that. And as I say, if I jump Google PAC West Conference, Real Estate Vancouver, and it'll come up with all the details. You can look at the full roster of speakers. It's going to be a quality event. And then, of course, the Be the Better Broker Conference will be happening for the second year in a row up in Whistler come February 5th, 6th, 7th. And that's actually on track to sell out. It's looking positive. So
I'm still on the WhatsApp. I'm a silent observer of the WhatsApp group that is thriving. Man, you're good at creating community, I'll tell you that.
I'm trying. Yeah. We're going to add another 100 people to that group here over the next 60 days or so, and it's going to be a great year again.
All right. Well, thanks again, Dustin.
All right. Take care.
So there you have, folks, our discussion with Renaissance Man. Let's call him that. Renaissance Man, Dustin Woodhouse. I love that conversation. It's always great listening to Dustin and picking his brain. And I do think that the framing of where we're at in the real estate market was unique and got me thinking at least in a different way. So many takeaways there. What else do we have before we cut for the day? We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for all things real estate related, including the LiveWire. This is our weekly newsletter where you'll get VIP access to pre-sale projects. You'll get deal of the month. You'll get stats, different types of stats, sales ratios where you can delve into a specific neighborhood at a specific price point to see exactly
how those sub-markets or micro-markets are doing. It is such a useful resource. That's at the LiveWire. We also have, of course, tried and true, and I'll try this my best, private client services, because if you are not using private client services, you're standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, you get days on market, you basically get realtor level information at your fingertips for free with a private client services account. You can subscribe to that at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. You just have to click buy with us and we will set you up with a free account. There is no better time to be monitoring the market, because as these rate cuts ripple through the market, let's see how long it takes for an uptick to start. It may be starting right now, but the only way to keep your finger on the pulse is through private client services. And that's at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. If you want to talk about that, you can give me a shout at any time, 778-847-2854, or Matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com, or we'll skip Adam's contact this week. You can always get in touch with us as well at that Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed. And we will be back next week with another episode of the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
2,000 Faces for Radio. Subscribe today.